To set the tone for the meeting, I will read an extract from Chapter 1, Bill's Story, pages 7 and 8 of the Big Book. They did not need to tell me. I knew and almost welcomed the idea. It was a devastating blow to my pride, who had thought so well of myself and my abilities, of my capacity to surmount obstacles, was cornered at last. Now I was to plunge into the dark, joining the endless procession of sots who had gone on before. I thought of my poor wife. There had been much happiness after all. What would I not give to make amends? But that was over now. And the topic of tonight's meeting is working step 8 with a sponsee. And Tim will share anything between 30 and 45 minutes on the topic, after which the floor will be open for questions rather than the typical sharing. And with that, I will now hand over to Tim.
Hello, everyone. Tim Alcolic. So step 8, the book is slightly tricky here, because when you get to step 8, it says, by the way, you've already got your list. That little 8 appearing there. You've already got your list. It says you made it when you took step 4. Well, I mean, in the same sense that, you know, well, if you want to write a letter, all the letters are already in the alphabet. You just have to put them in the right order. It's a bit like that with step 8. Yeah, you've done the list, but step 4 covers an awful lot of other material as well. So I think the best way to do this is to treat step 8 as a completely new exercise. You can't do a step 9 off the material in step 4. You just can't do it. It needs to be all the extraneous material needs to be stripped out, and you need to have a forensic analysis of just your behavior. So obviously the work done in step 4 is not wasted. It forms the basis for the work in step 8. As with step 4, so when you're doing step 4, you want to get the scope of the exercise clear first. And I think it's the same with step 8. So it's interesting. If you read Bill's story, he talks about approaching all of those to whom he'd harmed or who he'd fallen out with, basically. So what I get people to do, I think step 4 is very, very internal usually, and people have a little bit of sketchy understanding of how they've been interacting with the world. This is where we want to do a proper forensic analysis. Forensic being the adjective for with criminal law. We want to do a forensic analysis of all of the relationships. And so I think a very good place to begin with step 8 is to do a list of all relationships, present or past, who you definitely owe amends to or have harmed in some way, or B, feel uncomfortable about. Because if you feel uncomfortable about them, well, something's been missed so far. You've had a good go at forgiving everyone in step 4. You're still upset with Auntie Susan. Well, we need to look at that. You can't just brush it under the carpet. And this is all on the basis of first of all, Bill's story. You want to look at two types of thing in step 8. You want to look at the people you've harmed. You want to look at the people with whom you have unresolved tension. And Sandy Beach also will say that if you've got trouble with another person, you need to either forgive them or make amends. And sometimes those are two very closely related projects, which is why putting them into one project is a very helpful exercise. Also, the step 8 in the 12 and 12, I don't really use the 12 and 12, but there are some ideas in it that I borrow. In the 12 and 12, it will say that about the most useful thing we can do is have a thorough examination of our human relationships, because that is what has caused our failure and indeed our alcoholism. Now, I'm not going to stand in judgment as to how accurate that observation is, but safe to say, I think it's important enough not to be completely disregarded. So step 8 is where we just look at how we're interacting with other people. So as with step 4, you scope it out so you know the worst of it. There's nothing worse than wondering what else is in the woodwork that's going to come out. Get the name out now, then you can walk around the whole thing. And maybe you've got 400 names, maybe you have 200. Sometimes one of the things that people will say, and this is very common. I'm going to start being naughty now. People will come back with a step 8 list with like 8 names on it or 5 names. I had a sponsee that was in his late 60s who I know from his step 4 had punched half a dozen people. And yet that's just punching. Like the only, you know, if we were just looking at people you punched, it would be more than 5. And he had just 5 people. So I just don't believe it. I just don't believe it. We're not looking just at sort of grave crimes, but we're looking at the whole of our conduct. So really anyone should be on there where one hasn't behaved appropriately, where one hasn't acquitted oneself appropriately. Because otherwise, if the name is not on there, you're not going to get to examine it. Now, there's going to be an awful lot of repetition, so don't worry that putting a lot of names causes problems with having to write huge amounts. It isn't, because lots of things repeat. So with sponsees, if you have 49 sponsees, you probably ill-treat them all in exactly the same way. You know, there might be a few quirks here and there, but it's the same with classmates or bosses or colleagues or customers. So even if there are lots of names, it doesn't mean there's necessarily lots of writing, because most people have a limited playbook. So you get your list of names and then the analysis starts. Now I play this one of two ways. I either get people to do the whole of the step 8 first, and then we go on to step 9. And unless someone has got some experience of the program, I won't do that, specifically because when we start to go through the step 8s together, we discover that the step 8 is a dog's dinner. That's a technical term. And so there's no point in people writing reams and reams and reams of stuff wrong, only to have the whole thing sent back. You might as well get them to do a little bit and go through that and actually start to make some amends, because every time you make an amend, you're clearing some of the wreckage. You're making your own perception and interpretation clearer, which actually helps the rest of the step 8. Trying to get someone to achieve clarity on all of their harms without having made a single amend is usually you're on a hiding to nothing, frankly, because they won't be able to do it. People need to get some experience of amends to get a sense of how accurate their memory is, for one thing. Step 8 needs very careful calibration. Some people need to turn the dial up and look at things more honestly and carefully. Others need to turn the dial down and not accord themselves such weighty significance in the affairs of others. And it's only by making amends that I find out whether I'm exaggerating my harm, or in my case, it was underestimating the harm in almost every case. I got it substantively wrong, so how I harmed people was wrong 9 times out of 10. And I underestimated, sometimes I overestimated. So the experience of making amends is probably the most useful source of guidance for writing a step 8, but you've got to start somewhere. So with most people, unless they're very clear-minded, I will, in which case I get them to do the whole step 8 and then we just bash through. With someone a few weeks ago, we went through his whole step nine list in about 2 hours and it was just done. It's very rare that that's going to work out. Because, as the big book says, maybe your husband lives in that strange world of alcoholism where everything is distorted or exaggerated. So the whole thing needs to be rewired. It's not going to happen overnight and you have to do it. It's painstaking, this. So what I get people to do most of the time is say, pick a name off the list. Or maybe five names off the list. And pick the ones you anticipate are going to be the most straightforward in terms of figuring out what you did wrong. Now, what most people hear is write about parents and siblings and ex-spouses and current spouses. They pick the five most complicated relationships first. Literally, 9 out of 10 people do that. You say, pick the simplest one. They pick their mother. You seriously think that's the simplest relationship in your life? I still don't understand why people literally can't hear pick the simplest one to mean pick the simplest one, but no one can. So you have to, I literally have to say to people, not your mother, not your father, not siblings, not spouses, not children. Got that. And then 2 out of 3 still come back with the spouse or the mother. It's psychotic, but there we go. Anyway, so you find some simple ones and you work on those first. And what we're doing here is trying to nail exactly what the conduct was that possibly might have harmed someone. So your three columns are column one. What did I do? What did I fail to do? What did I say? What did I fail to say? So concrete, I, verb, object, or I, verb, complement, or I did, or maybe negated. I didn't do this. I didn't do that. Where it says in the 12 and 12 that defective human relations are at the root of all of our problems, including our alcoholism, I think the reason for that is because most people, and it was true for me, I couldn't tell the difference between inside of me and outside of me. I couldn't tell the difference between the inside of you and the outside of you. I couldn't tell the difference between me and you. So if I thought that you were thinking something, you had literally said it. So I would imagine you were thinking something about me and it would turn into you literally said that. One great example of where this, okay, so the first column, what did I do? And the variations. Second column, what should I have done instead? We'll come to why that's relevant in a minute. And third column, who was harmed and how? Now, with this first column, what did I do? You tell people, you try and tell people, you say you can tell an alcoholic, but you can't tell them much. You tell them, keep it nice and concrete. No, and what I tell people, I explain what abstract language is, and I explain what metaphorical language is, and I say, don't use either of those. We don't want, because if you use imagery, the person has to guess what you mean. If you use abstract language, the person has to guess what you mean. Perfect example. What did you do? It was with her mother, I think. What did you do? She said, I created an atmosphere. What do you do with that? What you want to describe in the first column is what a CCTV camera plus an audio recording device would record. What would someone who is transcribing, either transcribing the tape or describing what they can see on the CCTV camera, what would they describe as going on? So other ones, I gave him a hard time. Well, that could mean 100 things. My favorite one, this you get bonus marks for this one. I didn't show her respect. What does that mean? You didn't open a door, you set fire to her hair, you stole her dog. What did you do? Well, I don't know. That's the thing that comes up. I don't know. Well, you were there. You get to use the faculty of memory. You see, the story that we tell ourselves about what happened replaces the actual memory. So, like, the psychological narrative becomes the memory of what happened, and you have to peel that back to literally what did you say or do? And say or do can include more subtle things like tone of voice or volume of speaking. You know, it doesn't, it can be the manner in which we do things as much as exactly what we do. And there sometimes a little bit of figurative language can work. So I stormed out of the room is pretty clear. You're using a figurative term, but we all know there's no ambiguity there, as opposed to I created an atmosphere. Footnote, what creating an atmosphere turned out to be was scowling, sighing, and pausing a long time before responding whilst staring intently at the person. Okay. Now that's clear. Sigh, what was it? You know, sighing, scowling, staring in silence. Now we've got a picture. You see, you're smiling because you can imagine that you've got the scene now. It's clear and it's concrete. Second column, what should I have done instead? Most cases, it's, well, I shouldn't have done it. The right thing to do is almost always self-evident. Where the second column is relevant, sometimes, you see, people take as their basis for doing a step eight what I feel guilty about. So it's very common if people have broken up from a partner of some description, or broken off contact with a friend, and they feel guilty about it. And you say, well, first column, what did I do? And this is, so you've got to be careful of language, which, as they say, queers the pitch. The use of the language can obscure the truth. So you can actually accidentally include some moral condemnation in the first column. I'll give you an example. Someone might say, I ghosted Albert. Now, ghosting is very, very specific. It was almost psychological term for sort of disappearing inappropriately out of someone's life. Now, what you literally did would be, I stopped returning phone calls. That's the fact. Now, whether that's ghosting or whether that's, let's say, Albert, whenever you speak to them, they just moan for half an hour and don't get a word, let you get a word in edgeways, and then criticize you at the end of the call. Not returning phone calls is completely sane. That's what you do once you've spoken to your sponsor and gone to 700 Al-Anon meetings. You decide it's okay to not return the calls, even though you have to go and throw up because it makes you so tense, the idea of not returning the call. So we've got to know, well, what was the right thing to have done? So I broke up with I broke up with Kevin. Second column, what should I have done instead? Well, I should have broken up with Kevin. Kevin was a gambler in relapse with his gambling, and he was spending money on my credit cards, in which case breaking up with Kevin was a very, very good idea. Now, if what you did was right, i.e. the first column and the second column match, even if the other person was upset or hurt, I'm afraid hard luck. The reason being, in step nine, what you're going to go and say later on is, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done that. It was wrong of me. And you can only say that if you shouldn't have done that and if it was wrong. So the second column can help tease out, particularly with people who have a touch of codependency and feel guilty simply because someone else is upset. A good ex one thing A good example of how, if you want to manipulate a codependent, you can say something like, and I know because I've tried it, you can say something like, you're just not hearing me. And then the codependent will think, oh my God, I'm committing the terrible crime of not hearing you. I've done a terrible thing. I was talking to my other half about this phenomenon of not hearing the other day. And I said, what do you think people mean when they say that they haven't been heard? He said they usually mean that their unreasonable demands haven't been met promptly. So, no, they've heard you. They just haven't obeyed you, or they disagree with you. So so what I mean about you've got to be careful about the figurative language here, because it can obscure the facts of what's going on. So this second column can help reveal, particularly to people who feel inappropriate guilt, it can help people realize that what they did was right. And therefore, even though the other person, often a drinking or using addict or acting out addict of some description, when you have to set a boundary, they're often furious, absolutely furious, because you're no longer enabling them and, you know, writing them large checks and so on. It can help you see that actually you don't owe amends in all of these situations where you feel guilty simply because you haven't given in to someone else's manipulation. So those are the first two columns. But honestly, with most people, in most cases, the second column is just, it's fairly straightforward and it's almost redundant, really, because it's obvious that the action in the first column was inappropriate. Third column, how did the other person suffer? How was the other person harmed? And I draw this very broadly. And it's very simple, really. And this is why I did right from the beginning of AA, is I was asked to place myself in the other person's shoes and say, well, if I'd been treated like that, how would it have affected me? And it can affect people. The behavior can affect people in all sorts of ways. It can be physical injury. There can be taking someone's time, damaging their property, stealing their property, giving rise to inconvenience. Nuisance is a good general heading for all sorts of behaviors which fall short of actual harm, but are just incredibly annoying. So taking people's time, causing people to have to do extra work to work around you. And then the emotional ones. And I think this is where it gets interesting. Sometimes the emotional reaction is way out of proportion to what you did. But if what you did was wrong, you're responsible. Now, you're not responsible for the extent of the emotional reaction. In fact, they are responsible for their emotional reaction. And of course, you're not really causing it. You're occasioning it somehow because they've got a pre-existing condition, as it were. But if I'm wrong, then I need to apologize, even if the stink that it created was far greater than the actual crime. And there's a line in a Suzanne Vega song which absolutely captures this. A careless match in a very dry field. So lots of harms turn out to be careless matches in very dry fields, that one didn't necessarily intend great harm. One was either careless or negligent or rash or something. And this horrible chain reaction started, which dragged everyone under the bus. Even if the crime is small, and there was something where all I did in one of my more manipulative moments, I won't tell the whole story. I was in a meeting about, I don't know, 15, 16 years ago. And I was trying to work out whether the secretary, who was like two, or maybe GSR, who was maybe 2 years sober, wet behind the ears, whether or not he was aware that he was going to have to handle a contentious group conscience in a week's time. And if he wasn't, I was planning to kind of shoehorn myself in to coach him on how to handle it without obviously being, so I was positioning myself so that he would say, oh my God, am I taking the group conscience? I don't know what to do. Will you help me? That was the plan. So I sidled up to him. I sat down. I asked him how his day was. I asked him how his week was. Then I thought, now I'm going to go in for the kill. Hey, are you all prepared for the group to take the group conscience next week? I asked in the casualist voice I could muster. And he said, what do you mean? Take the group. And anyway, he promptly resigned as GSR. And I know. I mean, it's ridiculous. But I was I mean, it was very clear. It was very clear. I was being conniving and manipulative and sticking my all in to the situation. I was trying to interfere. And people always know, they don't not know. So he was reacting not to the comment, but to the obvious intent behind it, which was to muscle in. It created the most awful stink. And then I didn't attend the group conscience in question. And that was even worse because I was the one who'd called it. And it was just I think that the prophets call it a shit show. It was a shit show. Now, the actual things that I did wrong were relatively minor in themselves, but I'd set the ball rolling. You know, those Guinness Book of World Records domino competitions where like 20,000 dominoes all, you know, fan out in the shape of, you know, a map of Madrid or something. I'd hit the first domino. And yeah, the whole thing was set up to it. The thing was a powder keg. That group was a powder keg. But I let the match and threw it in. So I had to make amends to like 8 people, I think. And it was all ridiculous and everyone shouted at me. There we go. Don't worry with the third column about, you know, whether the other person's response was reasonable or not. If you set the ball rolling, you have to come clean and go and do your best. So I'm friends with all those people. And as far as they're still alive, I'm friends with all of them now. You know, the amends worked. It was fine. Once they'd shouted at me, they were fine. So there are your 3 columns. First column, what did I do? Second column, what should I have done instead? Third column, who suffered and how? Now, sometimes I've seen a situation with a few people recently. The person won't have been harmed per se, because they're just not that touchy. You know, they were older maybe, or more mature. They were wearing their big girls' pants that day. So, you know, they won't have been harmed, but some kind of acknowledgement of wrong is necessary, just as a matter of etiquette. So I think those are captured as well. So sometimes it's simply a breach of etiquette. It's the person hasn't been gravely harmed. Just because they haven't been gravely harmed doesn't mean etiquette hasn't been breached and there doesn't need to be an apology. This is particularly the case in professional situations. Or in situations where you're not a professional, but they're dealing with you in a professional capacity. They can totally handle it. I remember making amends to an HR human resources manager at an employer where I still think I was right in a sense of this contractual point. It was BS and everyone was furious about it. It was horrible. The whole situation was horrible. So it was changing our contracts and we were essentially, it was a pay cut for work which was being repackaged. But rather than just accepting this was an organization-wide decision and maybe there are reasons behind it and blah, 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 fine. Rather than doing that, I became, hard as it is to believe, I became vexatious. I was a gadfly, pecking at the barely exposed rump of the HR manager for over the course of several months with increasingly shrill and expertly worded emails with full of little barbs and sarcasms. It was really unpleasant. Sober, you know, not drunk, sober, whatever. Anyway, I made amends to Bernadette. I think everyone in HR at that point was called Bernadette. You call up HR and say, can I speak to Bernadette? They'd say, which one? I don't know. Anyway, I made amends to Bernadette and I said, you know, part of the form was, do you want to say your side of it? You know, how any of this affected you? And I love HR because they know how to be completely damning in such a sort of gracious, graceful way. She said, oh, I was fine. I've dealt with people like you before. So I didn't harm her, but it was necessary. I made a nuisance of myself and I breached etiquette. It was part of her job to deal with stuff like that, but I breached the etiquette in terms of the way I did it. It was vexatious. So don't be too pernickety about the third column. Sometimes genuinely no one is affected and it's laughable. It's just, as Tom says, you haven't harmed anyone. It's just embarrassing. But if there's a whiff of someone being harmed, then you go ahead with the amend. If it turns out they weren't, they'll tell you. And as one of my favorite stories, I'll finish on this. I was went to a restaurant with some friends and Jonathan was supposed to come along. And this is one of my favorite Jonathan lines. Jonathan was at work. And so he came to the restaurant about half an hour later than the rest of us. And we'd ordered by then. And a couple of the people were panicked that, you know, they'd ordered and then he was arriving after they ordered this. Oh, we're so sorry. We ordered without you. You know, it's really rude of us. And he said, the only insulting thing is the notion that I might be offended that you'd ordered without me because I was still at work. That's the only thing. So very often, if there was no offense, they'll tell you. And then, you know, the amend is mildly embarrassing, but it's over in 90 seconds anyway. So in a normal amends procedure, you're not losing anything except possibly face by trying it out. So if there's a whiff that the amend is necessary, go and make it. We'll come on another occasion to covert amends. There is such a thing as making an amend covertly, directly, but covertly. But anyway, as far as step eight is concerned, if there is a whiff of someone being harmed, you go and make amends. So that's all I've got on step eight. So, Alistair, do you want to skip over into questions if there are any?
Yes, thank you, Tim. I will now open up the meeting for questions rather than the sharing. And that can be done by the raised hand function, or you can message me in the chat or just shout out or wave your hand at the camera. Seamus.
That's cool. I didn't stick my hand up, but I have to say something now. sorry, I'm just pressing two buttons here. Okay. Got it now. Yes, I did have a question, actually. I wasn't going to ask it quite yet. I was going to wait until things had run dry. But it seems to be implicit in what you said, Tim, that... or rather, the situations you described seem to have a human agency at both ends of them. There is a person, and it reminds me of what it says in the 12 and 12 again, sometimes useful to refer to. I think Bill described harms as being the the results of instincts in collision. So there's a sort of bruising going on there. What's going through my mind is a category of thing called financial amends, which I've heard a lot about in meetings and never felt terribly enthusiastic about. And I know of people who have itemized every bottle of sherry that they've stolen from Marks and Spencer's and then gone to Marks and Spencer's and said, I want to see the manager. I need to pay for the sherry. And it causes all manner of difficulties with the accounts department. They don't know where to credit it and all the rest of it. But I suppose the underlying point is that there's a human being at one end of that, but at the other end of the transaction, you've got a corporation, which arguably is not an entity that can have instincts that can be collided with. And I suppose that there's a wider question there about how important it is to make amends to inanimate or possibly even malicious organizations. If you've stolen from the mafia, for example, under that scenario, then attempt to put that thing right, and what is right? So that's a bit of a rag bag of questions, but maybe if I just hone that down a bit, what do you think about this category of financial amends? Is it real? Is it significant, or is it actually a distraction, a way of distracting ourselves from the real thing, which is where harm has been done to living, breathing human beings?
Okay, that's great. There are actually lots of questions in there. When I follow the three columns, it actually takes care of that. What did I do? I stole sherry from somewhere. Should I have done it? No. There we go. So certainly those two columns are without doubt. So financial, whether it's stealing or so-called borrowing or damage, as far as step eight is concerned, I'm supposed to be looking at what behavior of mine is wrong. So it's irrelevant at the point of identifying whether it's wrong, whether it's a person at the other end, a corporation, the nation itself, the planet, or the Godfather himself. The action is wrong on its own merits. So that's the first thing. So all of the wrongs must be on there, and financial wrongs, whether it's stealing or fraud or any of those. I certainly did it in step eight. Otherwise, I wouldn't have. I don't think I would have completed step eight if I hadn't written those down. Now, those wrongs have to be set right, I think, one way or another, because any place which reminds me of a wrong that I haven't righted, it's as though there's a sort of pall that hangs over it. And I remember there was a particular employer where I'd left. I had an end date, but I walked out about 7 or 8 working days before the actual leave date over being what I thought was diddled out of a bonus. I'd been induced to stay several months after I'd given my notice on the basis that if I stayed, I'd get a particular bonus. Then the bonus day came and then there was no bonus and they found a technicality for not paying me, and I was livid. And my paycheck had cleared for that month. I'd effectively tied up all the loose ends. I'd done all the handovers. So the only harm by leaving was denying the employer work in respect of the money that I'd cashed. Now, I think they knew they'd be naughty at the time, because when I stormed out in high dudgeon, if I put the key fob inside an envelope, the key fob to get into the building, I put it inside an envelope. This was on the day that everyone got the bonus letter except me. I went into the finance director's office. He was having a meeting with some clients, so embarrassing situation. And on the envelope, I wrote quid pro quo, question mark, no quid, no quo. Now, they didn't come after me for those 7 or 8 days that I didn't work, which they paid me for. And I think they recognized that the whole affair was sort of murky, frankly. On both, well, their behavior was murky and then my response was murky. But when I did make amends for that, irrespective of their poor behavior towards me, none of my business. It's my behavior towards them which mattered. I realized that I had been avoiding that part of London in case I ran into anyone from there. And as soon as I made the amend, this cloud lifted from over Leadenhall Street and Leadenhall Market. I no longer needed to avoid Leadenhall Street and the adjacent roads. So something must be done. If I've done things wrong, something must be done with all of them. Now you've got three situations, I think, with apart from straightforward financial amends, you know, with people you've stolen or borrowed from and not paid back, where it's a human being and there's clearly a relation, an ordinary human relation which needs to be dealt with. You've got four further categories. Was it three or four? Anyway, you've got corporations. How do you deal with corporations? Corporations and governments and local authorities and so corporate entities or bodies of some description. Secondly, you've got, do you make financial amends to the nefarious? You know, whether that's your example of mafia. I've not come across that, but I have come across plenty of people owed money to, more sort of low grade East London organized crime or drug dealers, things like that. Or indeed, I've met plenty of people that refuse to make amends to corporations or governments or local authorities on the grounds that they're all evil and bent anyway. So we don't owe them anything. These people are quite happy to walk along a street paid for by taxpayers, but nonetheless, you know, they don't hover above it for fear of touching the evil tarmac. But that's an argument that people use sometimes. And I deal with the, and then you've got the question of where the sort of victimless crimes, where it's very difficult to identify who the amend is owed to. So now this does come into the third column, really, who suffered and how. And I think it's quite right with going to the local Sainsbury's trying to sort of pay for the bottle of sherry from 1974 is just going to cause problems. But something needs to be done. Now, the third column actually solves this with the corporations. So the two big examples that you get an awful lot of are number one, shoplifting. And all of those related things. Number two, benefit fraud. Social security, so if you're not in the UK, social security fraud or bending the rules there. Now, although the entity with which you've been interacting is faceless, as it were, and yes, there are people who are fronting it, but they're just representatives of the organization. They're not the organization itself. So the local ...2021 has not been harmed by what someone stole from that branch 2 years ago. probably not the same manager. They're not, hasn't been personally harmed. But if stuff is stolen from a corporation, the shareholders of that corporation have suffered. And who are the shareholders? With lots of these corporations, it's people who've got their savings or their pensions or their insurance policies invested in large corporations. So it's people like my mother, whose income depends on, whose very modest income depends on the returns from investments, which in turn are made in Sainsbury's and Tesco's and all of these other big corporations. So there is someone who suffers at the end of it, but it's massively diluted. So who suffered and how? It's the shareholders of the corporation who suffered. How do you make amends to the shareholders of the corporation? We'll tune in next week for that. But the short version is a very good way round this to actually get the money at least in the right ballpark. It's very difficult. You can't really give large corporations money, but what you can do is you can help support the local community causes that they all now support through their corporate social responsibility, so that you're as it were relieving the corporation's burden, whether or not that, you know, an aggregate has an effect on the shareholders, I don't know, but that's the closest you, I think that's the closest you can get. So there are ways of getting pretty close, and it's a similar question with where who suffered and how with benefit fraud. Well, it's not the local benefit office. The people that work there have not suffered. The person who suffered is the taxpayer. A friend of mine asked around, just as an experiment, asked a number of people, if there's a bloke in AA that's now sober who defrauded, it's usually housing benefit. That seems to be the one that people manage to, you know, get the authorities on. If you've got someone that's defrauded the housing benefit people to the tune of £10,000, should they come clean, giving rise to prosecution and all of the costs associated with that? Police time, legal assistance, money, the costs of the courts. There are lots and lots of costs associated with that, not to mention the risk of your future unemployability or reduced employability because of a criminal record. Or would you prefer that person to contribute to the public good to the tune of £10,000 plus interest? Every single one, who are all taxpayers, who are the people who are ultimately harmed by the benefit fraud, said, no, I would want them to contribute that money to the public good. And several of them spontaneously suggested, how about housing charities? If someone has defrauded the got housing benefit, well, maybe that's the way they can give back. So there's a way of making it, there's a way of personalizing all of this. When I've done wrong, I do have a relationship. It may be amorphous, it may be difficult to pin down, but it's there and something needs to be done about it. And one very good example of this is and this is a very personal view, so this is not meant to be an instruction to anyone else because it's a contentious matter. But I started to get feel very awkward about carbon. So a few years ago, I started to offset all my carbon, and I didn't just work out what it was. I actually multiplied it by 3 and then offset that with forest planting projects. And that changed my attitude. That changed my emotional attitude towards environmental things. I still believe the same things. I still belong to the same party. I still give money to the same causes. But funnily enough, the terror went out of it. An awful lot of projection outwards of anger and rage and hatred and condemnation comes from my own repressed guilt, which I can't get rid of because it's in me, for my own conduct. Unless that conduct is amended one way or another, I'm going to continue to project out. Once the guilt is gone, the projection stops. Last point, with the ne'er-do-wells, I think if I'm speculating here, I think if I owed the mafia, I'd probably pay them off first, just not to get killed. But that will be it. I mean, that's pure speculation. People disagree with this on drug dealers. I didn't have drug dealers on my list, so I can't speak from experience here directly, although I've had lots of sponsees who have. I've had many sponsees who have paid back their drug dealers. Very often the drug dealers are, they'd be shopkeepers in another world where drugs were legal. They've got a little business, it's illicit. And with my sponsees, the drug dealers were just kind of ordinary local drug dealers, not, you know, the organized crime style of drug dealers, and they just paid them back. I've got a good friend of mine who says absolutely not, it's immoral to contribute to a situation to return money into a system which causes so much harm. And I think there are, as Felix Frankfurt has said, there are matters on which reasonable people of goodwill disagree. And so I think paying back ne'er-do-wells or criminals or whatever is a contentious point. But the thing is, I'd have to ask myself, what is the principle here? Does that mean I only make amends to nice people in general? Do I have to judge each person's worth? Do I have to judge their behavior? If their behavior is also bad, do I not make amends? It's difficult to do. There are ways of finding principles to justify that position, but I think there's a danger of legalism there. Exactly how one does it with criminals as well is a matter of one has to approach those sorts of things very, very cautiously, but that's more of a step nine issue. So I don't know if that goes any way to answering your questions, Seamus, but I think that's all I've got on those.
Thanks, Tim. Karen, you had your hand raised and then you lowered it. Was that?
Yes, thank you, Alistair, and thank you for hosting this, and thank you, everybody that's here. And Tim, thank you for taking this hour out of your day to be with us. You said something at the ending, and I wanted to know what you meant for it. You were talking about direct covert amends?
Yes.
Can you give an example of what you mean by that?
There's a phrase, discretion is the better part of valor, which is... it's from one of the Shakespeare plays, I'm pretty sure. And it's one of those phrases where it's very difficult to discern the meaning from the words. But I think the sense is discretion is more important than valor. It's much more important to be discreet than it is to be brave. There may be a cultural difference between the British and the Americans here in that... the cultural stereotype, right or wrong, and America is a big place and it's actually 11 nations, not one, depending on which historian you read, 9 or 11, depending on the historian and the historian's earlier books or the later books, that they disagree on the number of nations within America, and each has its own culture. So Maine is different than New Mexico, for instance. Inland Maine is different than coastal Maine. There we go. But Americans have the stereotype of having their heart on their sleeve, and the British have the reputation of pushing everything under the carpet and being very uncomfortable with anything open. Sometimes the bad behavior, let's say the bad behavior is ill temper and crossness and so on. The harm done, you see, this is a direct amend. What we're doing is, if possible, to amend the harm that's been done, to rectify the harm that has been done, like sewing up a fabric that's been ripped. If you're if you've been cross with someone or ill-tempered or something, and the risk is that they think you're upset with them or angry with them in a sort of general way. Or if you've had harsh words with a friend, or even just slightly tense words with a friend, sure, you could have some candid conversation about what happened last Thursday. But often opening up that can of worms actually leaves it, it can create a bit of a stink. It can ruin that day as well. And then there are more misunderstandings and then you're back at square one. But simply resuming normal operations, being very careful and solicitous and kind and even tempered, and doing something to give the person the understanding that you love them and that you care for them and that you're not angry with them, and what happened has happened, but it's not going to be held against you. Do you know what I mean? There are ways of mending the harm in the relationship without having to have a sort of Danielle Steele conversation about it or a Barbara Taylor Bradford conversation about it. So making amends directly, it doesn't necessarily mean a conversation. It does mean that something has to be mended. Now, that's not, I don't think that that's licensed. People will, the dangerous thing of talking about this is people will seize on that, say, well, I shall make living amends. And then they don't do anything. And by that, they mean doing literally nothing more than they would ordinarily do, but double counting ordinary everyday human behavior as making amends and then ticking step 9 off the list as though something has been done when it hasn't. So that won't do either. Very often a conversation is necessary. But also with a good example of where a covert amend is necessary. One of the principles in step 9, except when to do so would injure them or others. One of the ways in which you can injure someone by making amends is by trying to make amends for something which they either didn't know about or sensed dimly, but had no proof of, had no verbal confirmation of. And in those cases, if you were to reveal your inner landscape, especially if the person has no emotional resources or resilience or maturity, emotional maturity or emotional intelligence or wisdom or any of those things, they simply wouldn't be able to process your revealed inner landscape, and it would sit there. I'm sure some of you have got relatives who remember what was said in 1974 and shall never, ever forget it. So one must be very careful about saying things in amends, which are new. One should, I think, I only have an overt conversation about what was overt, and not to. So there, you're going to be making amends directly by showing kindness and going massively above and beyond what you would normally do in order to mend the harm, but without saying a word about what you're doing or why you're doing it. So that's a direct but covert amend. So the directness of the amend is more important than whether it's overt or covert, but there has to be something which goes above and beyond what is required of you just as an ordinary human being. So that's my answer to that.
Thanks, Tim. Does anyone else have any questions for Tim?
Hi everyone, Dan Alcoholic.
Dan.
Thanks, Tim. Yeah, I had a question on, so the first day of senior school, I had a punch up with another kid, and we went on to become friends in school, and I don't ever remember there being an apology between us or anything, but it was like it didn't happen, right? It was just sort of accepted as a rite of passage or whatever it was. But there was no animosity and we were friends until we left school. So with something like that, obviously there was a situation there. And if that would have went the other way and I would have been, sworn enemy, then that would be a different story. But if you turn into friends, do you think that requires an amend, or that's
Yeah, it's a really, really good, it's a brilliant example, but that's a perfect example of the situation where column one, what did you do? I punched him in the face. Column two, what should I have done? Said, not punched him in the face. Third column, who suffered and how? No one. Because it was, there's a thing that doctors used to write in medical records in Norfolk, which is famed for having people with a slightly unusual genetic profile, rightly or wrongly thought. I mean, I don't know. I'm not from Norfolk. Doctors would literally write NFN, normal for Norwich, or normal for Norfolk. And so things which anywhere else would require explanation, we're just not even going to go there. So there are lots of things where what is right or wrong, whether someone was harmed or not, will depend on the social setting. So there are business practices which in one field would be disciplinary offences or grounds for legal claims, but which in other sketchier areas of business, for instance, nightclub promotion, where the certain practices fly where they wouldn't somewhere else. So I think that's why the third column, who suffered and how, is so important. And there are two ways of coming at the third column, either speculating as to what happened, you know, if I had been in that position, how would I have felt? Or simply looking at the evidence. Is there any actual real world evidence that anyone was worse off on any level as a result of this? Is there anything to indicate that anyone was harmed? And what you're telling me with that situation is there was no indication that anything was harmed. Similarly, if maybe there was, but it's blown over and it's been forgiven and forgotten and just chalked up. And my old sponsor, Brian, would say all is fair in love and war. There are some things where a certain amount of rough and tumble is par for the course, is normal in certain types of relationships, certain types of environment in the city, which I've worked in, where people were very rough with each other in a way that you couldn't get away with now in most working environments. But it was normal for how those city firms operated 25, 28 years ago. So you just sort of sucked it up and you toughened up, and that was just part of the deal. So a lot of it is contextual. What's the social context? Where is it? What's the domain of life? What's the social context? Who were the people involved? Were they actually affected? So the third column actually can bring up some really interesting information.
Thanks, Tim. Is there anyone else? Question? Okay, it doesn't seem to be the case.
One tiny thing. There's one tiny thing. Sometimes you get super complicated situations. And what you get people to do, I'll keep this really brief. What you get people to do is to write a little dramatis personae at the top. Who's who? Names and roles. And then the events that occurred in the order that they occurred with no analysis. Just this is what happened. Then this happened. Then this happened. Then this happened. With your contribution highlighted. And with each contribution, was that right or wrong? Was that right or wrong? Was that right or wrong? And then you find out what the aha. So it was at, you were fine up until you tore up the plane ticket. That was the thing that you did wrong. But sometimes you need to get it out. You need to get the whole array of characters first, and then the events in chronological order, and then you can make head or tail of it. So that's a helpful way to help people untangle tricky situations.
Is there anyone else with a question? Okay, if not, I'd like to hand back to Tim to close with serenity prayer. Please feel free to unmute if you care to.
Thank you. Would you please join me in the serenity prayer? God, grant me the serenity, to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Thanks, Tim. Thanks, Alistair.
Thank you.
See you soon, everyone. Thanks. Bye.